Being mindful of our time, I'm going to go ahead and make our introduction of our esteemed panel. As Reverend Wallace says, we do need each other, and one of the things that we are learning is that we can't do this alone. We can't only do this as Christians or as Muslims or as Jews. We need to start the dialogue, and we need to start talking to one another. And not only talking to one another, we need to listen to one another. And we hope that tonight is a conversation that will continue throughout our community and broadened even beyond that. So I will introduce our four panelists, and then we will welcome them as one. First, I'd like to introduce Samina Fahim Sundas, who is the president of the American Muslim Voice in Palo Alto. Welcome. And next, we have Rabbi Paula Marcus, who is a local associate rabbi. Next, we have Reverend Renee Schlepfer. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay. Who is the senior minister at Twin Lakes Church here in town. And next, we have Sheila Lynch, and I'm going to read this to be sure I get it right, who is the director of Family Life, Respect Life, and Social Justice at the Diocese of Monterey. Welcome. We've invited each of our panelists to briefly respond to the speech that Reverend Wallace has given, ask a question or a comment, and then Reverend Wallace has been invited to respond to their comments.
Assalamu alaikum. That means peace be upon all of you. That's a Muslim greeting, Islamic greeting. I need about an hour to talk to Jim Wallace. Shannon asked me before, she said, would 2-3 minutes be fine? And I said, yes. But I didn't hear him before that, Shannon. I'm sorry. I do agree with you. You know, we need politics, hope, and all that. But we also need politics of inclusion. Right now, it feels like only white, male, rich people can win elections. And I think until all of us feel part of that, until we feel that we belong in all aspects of life, we cannot protect this country as one. So that's number one. Mm-hmm. I have about a long list to go, bear with me. You're absolutely right, we cannot do it alone. And that's why I founded American Muslim Voice about 3 years ago. And right after 9/11, there was an interfaith dialogue that started. That was a wonderful first step. But we needed to go beyond that again if we are going to change, you know, this country, and if we are going to move mountains, we need to stick as one. If we are all divided, just like our administration has done that after 9/11, taken that tragedy to gain their, you know, elections and win the elections, they have created a culture of hate, anger, division, confusion. We need to replace it with a culture of peace, hope, mutual respect, and harmony. And that's what I felt, that the need to have American Muslim Voice, where we go out and open our doors, our hearts, our homes to one another. We invite, and we do open houses, not in our mosques, not in our community houses, but we do that in our homes. We want to welcome all of our fellow Americans so they get to know us, who we are, not listen to the administration, not listen to the media, because all they are giving you is false information about Muslims and Islam. And as people of faith, especially people of faith, I think it is our duty that when we hear something, we verify the facts. And how do we do that? We can only do that by going to the source. It's again, when I was a young mom, people used to tell me, oh, some expert is coming at Stanford who's going to give a lecture about how to raise children. And I said, how many children does he have? He has none. He has a PhD. Well, I don't care about the PhD. I want to see how many children has he dealt with in his life, 24 hours, 7 days a week, for the rest of his life. It's the same thing. If somebody so-called expert who doesn't really know the heritage and the beautiful, peaceful religion that I believe in, please go to the source. There are so many websites, and I'm told CIA's website is the best if you want to learn about Islam. So, you talked about, you know, Detroit. I have never been depressed in my life until I visited Detroit. That was in 2003. I was going to speak at a conference, and when I saw there are so many homes that are burned, there are neighborhoods that are empty. It seemed like a ghost town. And I asked people, where are the people who live in this city? And a lot of the places were just empty. And I said, why are there so many homes burned? They said a lot of the time when people get too poor and they can't afford the mortgage and all that, they set fires on their own house to claim insurance. That's the saddest thing I have ever heard. And if I did find people, their bodies were there, but they were hollow. If you look in the eyes, there was nobody there. There is no soul there. Since 9/11 only, our government has spent billions of dollars making this country supposedly safe. And the latest talk they're having is that racial profiling should be legalized. And I was on this show from Boston. It was like a Fox radio. I have never felt so much hate and anger as I felt during those 2 hours. I was told, we hate all Muslims. You are all terrorists. If you're not terrorist now, right now, you're going to be terrorist. So they know me better than I know myself. So it's a lot of the things are going on. What makes me wonder is why people of faith are so quiet. Why are we letting, you know, different communities being targeted? I was telling this radio host, I said, you know what? If you're going to do the profiling, and if you profile only Muslims, you're not going to make this country safe and secure. It's not good for America. He said, why not? All the Muslims are doing bad things. I said, okay, suppose if all the Muslims are doing bad things, if you target only them, if you only profile them, terrorists are not stupid. They are going to hire somebody who is going to look like you to do their dirty work. So we are jeopardizing our country. Again, war with Iraq. I keep hearing there's over 65% of the people who are against the war. Why are we not on the streets? Why is there is a rally? There are 2,000, there are 10,000. Where are those people? So there are so many things that we need to go through. Third graders, to hear about that, you know, peace academies and peace, you know, culture and people who are trying to change the gangs into peaceful people. UC Santa Barbara, I was speaking at a conference, and that's the fact I heard there that sent chills to my bone. If a third grader fails a standardized test, our government starts building prisons for them, rather than just making sure that they have some tutors or some help. How does an 8-year-old know that if I fail today, I have a reserve confirmation number in a prison? There is something wrong. We are not valuing our kids. We are not valuing our future. Again, people of faith, all of us need to stand together and build this America where all of us feel at home and comfortable.
We're going to have to go on, but thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Do you have one last comment?
No, it's okay.
Okay, thank you. Reverend Wallace, would you like to respond? Reverend Wallace, would you like to respond, or would you like to hear from? Okay, thank you.
First, I want to say thank you so much to you, Reverend Wallace, and also to this community for bringing all of us together today. This is the second time I've got to be with Samina, and I appreciate that so much. There's a few things that I want to say, and I want to thank you so much for asking us to look at ourselves first. In Jewish tradition, this is the season where we do what is called teshuvah. We do returning to ourselves, returning to each other, returning to the right path. And so for me, that was particularly powerful and I think very instructive for all of us. There's a teaching in Jewish tradition. I'll say it in Hebrew and then I'll translate it. Lo alecha amlacha ligmor. It is not upon you to finish the task. Ve'lo ata ben chorin lehivatel mimena. But you are also not free to desist from it. The day is long and the workers are tired. That's the last piece. But I think what you've said tonight is that if we don't begin, there's always a place to begin. And so what I take away from that is that this is the new year for Jews. We are coming into a new place and there's new potential. And you actually mentioned that in your book as well. So I want to appreciate that and lift that up a little bit. I had a congregant who I met for lunch last week, and we were talking about the sermons that I gave at the High Holidays. You know, 1,000 people, pretty great opportunity. And he said, you know, last year your sermons really didn't do it for me because you spoke about politics. And I really had to think about that. He said, your spiritual sermons are the ones that really hit me. And I thought, well, gosh, I have to do a better job of connecting the spirit and the politics if that's what's coming out, because that's the key. You know, I'm trying to teach biblical texts. And so I want to ask you a question which has to do with that. What do you believe is the best way, and what is the role for mediating institutions like churches and synagogues and schools to be able to help create the morality and political will for transformation that you speak about? What do you think are the best ways that we can be doing that in our own communities? One of the projects that this congregation, FCC, and Temple Beth-El are involved with is a faith-based organizing group called COPA, and I know there are many of you out here tonight who work with COPA. Communities organized for relational power and action. And what we do is through relationship with the people in our congregations and churches and schools and redevelopment, Live Oak Resource Center is one of the many of you have heard about, is we build power between ourselves to confront the people with power and make demands upon them that their agenda should be our agenda, which is, I believe, the agenda that you're talking about, the moral, biblical, prophetic agenda. So that's one of the ways that we found, but I'd like to hear more about that. Thank you.
Well, first I want to say I'm really glad to be invited here, but you know, I do feel a little bit like the start of a joke up here. So a pastor, a rabbi, a Muslim, and a priest go up to a bar and, you know. Yeah, we're going to work on that, all right. But seriously, Jim, as a pastor of an evangelical church here in a progressive city, Santa Cruz, I got to say thank you very much for your book, because being an evangelical here is sometimes a little suspect. It comes with a lot of baggage, and you so proudly kind of self-identifying as an evangelical, you know, you've made it easier for me at, you know, cocktail parties and stuff like that. And somebody actually came up to me the other day and said, so, you know, I read this book. I thought you evangelical guys were all like, you know, Jerry Falwell or something, until I read this Jim Wallace book. And I said, Jerry Falwell is my father. No, I didn't say that. But my question for you is this. It is great that you went back to the 19th century, you know, evangelicals, William Wilberforce and all those guys, and said, hey, you know what, well, we come from this tradition of social justice. And by the way, you know, we talked before the event about Rick Warren and his peace plan, where here is probably the largest evangelical megachurch in the country. It's here in Southern California. He's very influential with the Purpose Driven Life book. But now he's really started to emphasize this. And we need to be interested in illiteracy and eradicating poverty. And our church has officially adopted that and has really aggressively gone after issues of social justice more in the last couple of years than ever before. And you know what has happened that has surprised us is there's a new spiritual vitality. And here's something that I didn't expect. It's also fun. It's actually fun to do this and exciting. And it's really brought a new life to the church. But some evangelicals would argue, in fact, as I think Don Miller did in a column that I read in the Santa Cruz Sentinel on Saturday, that's great. Evangelicals ought to be involved in these kinds of issues. But in the past, in the 19th century, all these great evangelical social justice movements, many of them gained political power but lost spiritual power. Sort of like what your question was about. They became, I guess the derogatory term is churches of the social gospel, and they lost biblical authority. They lost spiritual power. How do you maintain the emphasis on taking the Bible seriously, that say an evangelical or a Catholic would treasure, and yet still have that emphasis on social justice? That would be my question for you. Thanks.
I also want to thank everyone for inviting me to be part of this esteemed panel. Tonight, when I heard you, Reverend Wallace, talk about spirituality and social justice and how people are waiting to see this connected, and this is what needs to happen, I said to myself, we do this in the Catholic Church, or we try to do this constantly, but we have a very hard time communicating this. I mean, we have a very strong tradition of social justice that is, we try to filter it through everything. And every 4 years, the U.S. bishops actually put out a document called Faithful Citizenship, in which it talks about this, how our moral life and our political life and how to bring that together is part of our obligation as a Catholic Christian. And not necessarily how you vote on anything, but how do you negotiate this ground in between? How do we begin to make sense out of this? And I thought, you know what we've been lacking? We've been lacking the speaker on this. You know, we're great on press. Lots of hard copies of stuff float around offices. Everybody's got it. But to have that dynamic voice, to have that person who writes the book that everybody will read to begin the conversation, mm-hmm. That's what we've been waiting for.
Am I on? Yeah. So response, then we'll open it up to the folks out there. Okay. Samina, I think this question of inclusion is so critical on every level. By 2050 in America, most Americans will trace their lineage to Africa, Asia, or Latin America, will be predominantly a nation of color, and will also be more diverse religiously than we've ever been before. And we've got to not be afraid of that conversation. A guy walked into my office the other day, and he's kind of a second-tier Rick Warren. You know, he's a mega-church guy from Texas. He said, and he had somebody with him. He said, could you leave the room? I'd like to speak to Jim alone. I thought, what's he going to tell me? You know, and he said, I'm conservative on Jesus. I'm conservative on the Bible. I'm conservative on the resurrection. But I'm becoming a social liberal. And I'm finding the poor all in the Bible, and we're working in Afghanistan. I'm meeting Muslims, and I like them. and I'm learning things from them, and we talk about our faith, and it's not a fearful conversation. He said, am I the only one who's like this? I said, I want to hug him. No, there's more like you, you know. So I think that conversation is beginning, particularly among younger people. Paula, we had a thing in the rotunda of the Capitol one time. It's hard to imagine, but the Congress was actually cutting programs for the poor and giving tax breaks to the rich. Yeah. We were stunned. And so we had this circle, and it was Catholic women religious doing Catholic social teaching, and evangelicals and mainline. It was all Christians, though. And so I got a call from one of my favorite rabbis, Michael Lerner. And he said, you got room for a rabbi? I said, well, we're reading Isaiah. You can read the text. And so he got there in the rotunda of the Capitol, and he reads the text, Isaiah, woe to you legislators, right? You know the text, who pass infamous laws, denying the poor among my people of their rights. And so when you read that text in the rotunda and you sing and pray, they do arrest you. And so they arrested us all, and there was an eighth grade civics class happened to be in the rotunda learning about how our government works. And eighth grade kids, it's hard to get them quiet, but they were totally silent, bug-eyed, watching all these clergy and rabbis and Catholic sisters led away. And when we were finished, they cheered. And the New York Times said to this kid, "What did you learn today about citizenship?" He said, "Well, I learned that sometimes you got to stand up for what you believe, but when you do, it's good to have some people with you." And so we're in then jail, and Tony Campolo, one of my favorite, good, dearest friends, Baptist, evangelist, and Michael Lerner are sitting down, and they're having a rigorous conversation about who Jesus Christ was. Was he the Son of God? Was he merely a prophet? I mean, they're friends, but they were really going at it. It was a rigorous, serious, theological discourse in the D.C. jail about Christology. You know? And I watched it, and I finally figured this interfaith thing out. First, we all get arrested for our faith, then talk theology in jail. So inclusion is critical, and we do need each other. And looking at ourselves, Jesus said, "Why do you look at the log in your adversary's eye and not the one in your own eye?" This is a good lesson for foreign policy. So as you say from your tradition too, starting with ourselves is the best place to start. How do we organize? You both asked a similar question. You know, on the one hand, we've got to speak right to the heart of our traditions. This isn't about some kind of political ideology. The nation is tired of the left-right debate. It has polarized and paralyzed our ability to find solutions. And I am not offering a religious left to counter a religious right. The nation is hungry for something deeper, which I call the moral center. Don't go left, don't go right, go deeper. What are the moral choices and challenges that lie right beneath our political debate? And so, for me, I go right to the Bible with evangelicals all the time, the words of Jesus, and all the rest. But finally, and you both touched on this, how do you not lose the faith part? Or how do you really motivate people at not just about an issue, but about their faith? One of the things that I found most exciting about this tour is in the Q&A time, almost every time, I'm waiting for someone to ask me my Iraq exit strategy or something. And I have one. But it's like a young woman will say, "I came to faith because of this book. What's next?" Or an activist will say, "I was an activist before, but now I realize that without faith, I won't be able to sustain that. Is there a book about the options?" I said, "What do you mean?" "I don't know the options. Like, is there a chapter on, what is it, Episcopalism, Presbyterianism, Judaism? I need a book on the options." I mean, he was just starting from total scratch, you know. And I would just say this. In America, the quest for spirituality is a dangerous thing. In a consumer society, it could be so commodified, and it can be just another occasion for narcissism. Unless the quest for spirituality is disciplined by the struggle for social justice. On the other hand, the struggle for social justice by itself is a dangerous thing, because we can become bitter and cynical and burnout, and ideological, and angry, and hateful, and even violent. The struggle for social justice must be nourished by the quest for spirituality. That's why I say the two great hungers are for spirituality and social justice, and the connection between the two is what I see a new generation really hungry for. I'm an evangelical kid, but Sheila's got my number. I love Catholic social teaching. It's the most systematic kind of teaching. Better Protestants don't really have that straight. John Carr, who you know, right, in the Catholic bishop's office. John is, well, he works with the bishops, and he was in a conference one day with the bishops in an elevator. And somebody walked in and said, "Are you a bishop? You don't look like one." He says, "No, I work for the bishops." He had a wedding ring, and it was a giveaway, you know. And he said, "What's your job?" "I'm the head of social development and peace." And she said, "You're not doing a very good job." But, you know, I love Cardinal Bernardin from Chicago, former Cardinal Bernardin. I used to do clergy conferences for Cardinal Bernardin. And he had this notion of a consistent ethic of life, wherever life is threatened. The seamless garment, he called it. And it's still the best thing out there. Wherever life is threatened, we must engage. And I'm tired of this narrow, the selective moralities of left and right. You know, I'm tired of the kind of pro-life stance where, let's just put it this way, if I'm an unborn child and want the support of the far right, I better stay unborn as long as possible. Because once I'm born, I'm off their radar screen. No child care, no health care, no care. So, and I think America is hungry for someone to say, the abortion rate is this, these are moral issues. Hillary Clinton said it's a tragic choice. How do we dramatically reduce the number of abortions in America without criminalizing a desperate choice? This is the common ground that we can build and find a lot of support for, but it's a consistent ethic of life. So Catholic social teaching for me is really critical. I do think that I meet young people in all of your traditions almost every week, and you know, they want to run, and I want to just finish with my favorite biblical prophet these days is Habakkuk. Now, some of you don't even know who he is, but some say Habakkuk, some say Habakkuk. How many say Habakkuk? How many say Habakkuk? How many don't know what the hell I'm talking about? You know? Okay. Well, he's not a primetime prophet, you know. He's a minor prophet, you know. But he opens his chapter one by saying, "Oh Lord, why do you make me see violence? Destruction is everywhere. Justice comes forth perverted. Why do you..." And then he says, "I'll climb the watchtower to see what the Lord will say to me concerning my complaint." He's practicing the politics of complaint, which we do all the time. You know, Habakkuk is a liberal, you know. George Bush, oh, Donald Rumsfeld, oh, Dick Cheney, oh, they have little red marks on their heads, you know. And the right runs around, Michael Moore, Barbara Streisand, you know, it's like little red marks on their head. Then the Lord answered him. You know the text. The Lord will answer. Then the Lord answered me, "Write the vision. Make it plain so a runner can read it. For still the vision awaits its time. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay." There's a whole generation of runners ready to run. And they're looking for a vision to run to. And our job is to cast a vision and start running alongside these young kids. And we do that, I think we're going to shake the foundations again of this nation. Yeah.